Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, Oscar winner Mark Rylance. The cast of the new Netflix version of Rebecca, including Lily James, Armie Hammer and Kristin Scott Thomas. And Eurovision winner Linda Martin on her favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the News Talk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. As you heard there, I have serious star power on the show this week. An embarrassment of riches, but you know, better to have an embarrassment of riches than an embarrassment. I think Ryan Tuberty might have said that, but he won't mind me stealing his phrase. So I don't have a huge amount of time to, you know, tell you my normal spiel about what you should and shouldn't watch this week because I've just so much stuff to get to. But really quickly, and I don't enjoy telling you not to watch things. I don't really go in for that. As I've said to you before, what's the point? But that said, given the time of year, you might be tempted if you're scrolling through Netflix to watch the new Adam Sandler movie, Hubby Halloween, H-U-B-I-E, don't. It is awful. It's barely a movie. It's a series of unfunny jokes strung together with the approximation of a plot. It gives me no joy to say it because, you know, Adam Sandler was in Uncut Gems last year, which was a brilliant movie. And I was saying earlier in the week on The Hard Shoulder, it may be some elaborate joke, this movie. It is that bad. I'm sorry to say it. So avoid it. Incidentally, something great on Netflix that I'm enjoying at the moment is The Song Exploded, which is all about one song each week. And it's a famous podcast that I'd never heard of, to my shame. And this guy in LA meets musicians and talks through one particular song with them. And there's four episodes of it on Netflix. They've turned it into a TV series. It's really good. There's an episode with R.E.M.'s Losing My Religion and they play Michael Stipe, the original demo, and he kind of gets choked up. It's really good TV for the muso in your life. Now, as I mentioned, a lot of stuff on the show this week. First of all, the trial of the Chicago 7 was in cinemas 2 weeks ago. Me and Mark Ryle reviewed it. I think we both gave it 4 stars. It got a cinema release, then the cinemas closed. So I'm imagining a lot of you probably haven't got to see it. The good news is it lands on Netflix this weekend, the 16th of October, depending on when you're listening to this show, but this Friday, the 16th of October. Really interesting movie, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, he of West Wing fame. And it's all about, as the name implies, 7 disparate counterculture activists, let's say, in the late 60s, who were arrested for inciting a riot outside the Democratic National Convention. They were all loosely anti the Vietnam War. The trial was a bit of a farce in many ways. They were all brought together, even though they didn't really have any association with each other, apart from being loosely all anti the Vietnam War. As I say, the trial was bizarre. It's been turned into a movie by Aaron Sorkin, a really good one. It stars people like Eddie Redmayne, who plays one of the people on the stand, Sacha Baron Cohen, another guy in the dock who's surprisingly good in this. And I say surprisingly because he's funny, but he's also quite dramatic in it in a very good way. Jeremy Strong from Succession, Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays the prosecution lawyer. And the next guy I'm going to talk to, Mark Rylance, plays the lawyer who represented this disparate group of 7 people in the witness box. Their lawyer was called William Kunstler, very famous lawyer in the States who was kind of, I guess, you know, a guy who was on the liberal side of things and was very deeply involved with any client he ever took on and was kind of, most people thought, a force for good in the world. Anyway, Mark Rylance, he who won an Oscar for Bridge of Spies and has done all sorts of things, spoke to me about playing William Kunstler and some other stuff besides. Hi, Mark. John Fardy from News Talk Radio in Ireland. How are you?
Hi, John. Nice to hear you.
Lovely to talk to you. I've been a big admirer of yours for a long time, so it's a real pleasure for me. Let me get straight into it. I watched the movie last night, and I knew a bit about the trial from history class and all that, but I didn't know much about the movie. And I was really surprised by how funny it was at times because it's a serious topic. But And like your character as well is very funny at times, although serious. Did you read this script and think, wow, this is great. I got to be part of this.
I certainly read the script and thought, wow, I got to be part of this. I wasn't aware that my character was funny, though. I remember now that funny things happen to him because he's in a very unusual position and it changes his life. These people are not, these people are not just seeking for justice. They're also seeking for deep cultural change. And, yeah. And certainly Abby Hoffman and the character that Jeremy plays, they're using humor and they're using culture to try and undermine the foundations of so they're very Dionysian in that way.
Yeah,
they're Pan-like in their attempts to undermine Captain Hook.
Yeah, maybe your character isn't so much funny as laughably bemused at times. He's shocked a lot of the times, very funnily, by what's going on in the court, you know, as is the audience. Yeah. I was reading about him today, the character you play, William Kunstler, and he said this great thing, and I'm sure you know this, I only defend the people I love. And I read a bit about him, and, you know, he divided some people, but I'm assuming you thought he was very much on the side of the angels and you relished playing him.
Yeah, and the more and more I read about him, John, I that feeling just grew. He went on to defend the prisoners in Attica to try and mediate between the prisoners who were calling for better conditions and the authorities. And his heart was broken when the police went in and took over the situation, killing many of those prisoners, you know, and the ongoing terrible situation of American incarceration, not to mention Guantanamo. But he also remarkably went on to work for the Lakota people and to meet a man called Russell Means, who I was lucky enough to meet before he passed away, one of the founders of the American Indian movement. And they were Russell's widow, Pearl Means, who I know, told me they were all very, very impressed with him and with his capacity to understand not only the injustices of their attempts to honor Wounded Knee, but just to understand and enjoy their culture. And I've seen films of him dancing with them and reveling in the great wicked sense of humor that's a part of the First Nations people. You know, it's always a remarkable thing, the sense of humor that's bred. I remember making a film called Love Lies Bleeding up in Belfast.
Yeah.
And just being bowled over. This was in the early 90s. By the incredible sense of humor amongst the many Republicans that I met and people on all sides of the troubles up there, that it's a way to deal with great troubles, isn't it? To use a sense of humor. And I think the film shows that these remarkable young people employ a sense of humor in the way someone less talented would employ a fist or a gun or a bomb. Sense of humor is a really, really, they should be teaching it in every school, if you could.
Yeah. We kind of are a bit in the school my kid goes to. Listen, there's something in my head in front of an Oscar winner. It's like talking to an astronaut or a Sheffield United fan. You rarely meet them. So I just have to ask, is it as amazing a feeling as everyone thinks? You know, Robin Williams said, it's nice, it holds the mail, but I'm just wondering how you are about it a couple of years since to stand on that stage in LA with the thing an actor dreams of, I assume.
I'd never dreamed of it. You know, I it was a complete surprise. And I only went along because Spielberg said to me, I'm not really recognized as an actor, as director. I've made all these films, but Dan Day-Lewis is the only one who's ever won an Oscar, which I didn't know. And so I really went for him, you know, and I didn't expect to win at all. So it was a big surprise. It's not what it's cracked up to be. I thought there'd be lots of parties, you know. I thought I'd meet Jack Nicholson and I'd meet all these people that's what I went for. I wanted to meet all these wonderful actors that I grew up admiring. And I just really, you know, had to stand around with a lot of executives for many hours.
Dear.
I'm afraid it was like all these things. It wasn't what it's cracked up to be.
Oh, dear. Well, listen, it was all cracked up talking to you. Thanks a million, Mark. The movie's great.
Nice to meet you, John.
The great Mark Rylance there, a joy to talk to him. Winning an Oscar wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and you can currently see him in The Trial of the Chicago 7, now streaming on Netflix as of this weekend. Well worth a watch. Up next, the cast of the new version of Rebecca, including Lily James, Armie Hammer, and Kristen Scott Thomas.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. I'm John Fardy. Now, Rebecca, the famous novel by Daphne du Maurier, has been made into a movie not once, but now twice. It was made by Alfred Hitchcock, of course, back in 1940, starring Laurence Olivier and Joan Fontaine. And now it's been remade in a Netflix movie, a 2020 version, starring Armie Hammer, who plays Maximum de Winter, a man getting over the death of his wife, Rebecca. He meets a new young woman who he seems to fall in love with, marries her, and they move to his house in the English countryside, the famous Manderley. Lily James plays his new wife in this version, but she's obsessed with his dead wife, Rebecca, who seems to hold this almost paranormal grip on the house that she now lives in. It's a classic kind of gothic psychological thriller, and the new version is pretty good, I'm delighted to say. And also has a wonderful turn by Kristen Scott Thomas, playing Mrs. Danvers, the housekeeper who seems obsessed even more than Max de Winter with the now dead Rebecca. Let's take a little clip.
Mrs. Danvers, does Mr. de Winter ask you to keep the room like this?
It doesn't have to. She's still here. You feel her. I wonder what she's thinking about you. Taking her husband and using her name.
She just wants him to be happy.
Happy? No, he'll never be happy. She was the love of his life.
It's directed by Ben Wheatley. Ben Wheatley's done things like Sightseers, Kill List, High Rise, kind of specializes in horror, psychologically funny kind of movies. So this was quite a departure for him. And I got to talk to him about it earlier this week. I've been a follower and admirer of your career now since close enough to the beginning. And when I read that you were doing Rebecca, I was thinking, God, that's a departure for him. And then I was thinking about it, well, it's maybe it isn't. It's a gothic kind of horror kind of movie. Did it feel like a departure for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's like every film I'm planning to be a departure, and then every one of them ends up like quite similar. You know, I was just chuckling when I was making it, like halfway through, I'm going, God, this is really similar to Sightseers in a lot of ways. You know, yeah. It's a bit more glamorous, but it's kind of it does have similarities. So yeah, I thought. When I read the original script, I thought, oh yeah, you know, it's the kind of romance side of it and the would be the thing that makes it really different. But then it does kind of end up being that thing of jumping through different genres, which is something that's happened a lot in the films I've made, I think.
Yeah, and it is very genre diverse. It was one of the things I liked about it. It felt like Downton Abbey at times. It felt like Hitchcockian at other times. And I mentioned the famous bald, big belly director there. I know you're a big cinema buff. Was you know, is he on your shoulder in some way? The fact that he made the original? Are you thinking of Uncle Alfred at some stage when you're doing it?
No. I mean, I think you just have to, it's hard enough to make stuff without thinking about other people while you're doing it. And it's more like a kind of emotional reaction to the script on in the moment. I remember reading a quote by Cronenberg and David Cronenberg, and they're saying, like, how do you manage making a film? And he goes, oh, you just deal with it a scene at a time. And I think it's literally that. It's like at the beginning of it, you go in with this like massive amount of hopes and dreams about, you know, design and tone and all these things. And by the 3 days into the shoot, all you're looking at is like three lines and going, geez, if we can just get through this, you know. And I think it's kind of, you know, that kind of concentration, you just live it a scene at a time. So yeah, the actual worrying about other filmmakers is not something that happens.
Sure. And then do they always kind of work out though? Because I can imagine that. I can see you're sitting in a room and you have this idea and you're going to direct this. You think this is going to be great. And then you get into the meat and bones of it. And, you know, some guy doesn't show up with the rain machine or blah, blah, blah. And you get through it. But your movies, you know, I'm a fan of all of them. They always get there. Do you end up at the end going, we got there most of the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've gotten harder as it's gone on, because I think I started off as a kind of slightly arrogant and callow about the process. And as I've done more movies, I've just been ground down by the reality of how hard it is, you know? And so now I'm more of like a slightly punch drunk kind of, a boxer near the end of his career kind of thing, kind of, oh my God, I've got to do this. And how's it going to work? So you just become more and more nervous, but the process is always the same, you know.
Yeah.
You do it, you make it, and you kind of get it back to the edit suite, and then you're in a state of absolute terror before you watch it for the first time, and then you watch it and you go, oh God, now it's about taking it apart and putting it back together again, and then it's done and it's okay, you know. So it's the same, yeah.
Yeah, well, this is more than okay. I was talking to some of the other cast, and you have a great cast. Were these, like, I don't know how it works, who casts who or whatever, but this must be your wish list, is it? I mean, you can have no complaints with the people you got.
No, it's brilliant. I mean, they were all fantastic, and I was talking about to someone the other day, and, they're going, oh, you know, how did you direct so-and-so or whatever? And I'm like, it's not directing. It's like you're watching the monitors, and these people are brilliant. And it's like there'd been a lot of rehearsal. We'd worked out a lot of the stuff beforehand. So really, it's just a massive treat for me. You know, I kind of, you know, and then certainly with someone like Christian Scott Thomas, who's such an intelligent and passionate performer, you're just basically unleashing them rather than the conversations between us aren't the specifics of what I want from them. You know, because I've already done that through the rehearsal period and through the casting, pretty much. Mm.
Yeah. And just finally then, you seem remarkably free of pretentiousness about the business of making movies. Is that, what do you put that down to? You don't seem to talk about bit ratios and, you know, mise-en-scene or any of that stuff. You're quite a straight talker. Do you consciously try and stay that way to let people in almost? Because your movies aren't pretentious either.
I remember seeing a thing about the New Order, which I really like, where they said, you know, why do you play the way you play? And they said, well, we don't know how to play any other way. No, that's how they learn, you know. Yeah. And I think that's right. And it's that unique sound that they have is just because they came up that way. I think it would be very hard to put over a character that you weren't. Certainly in like lots of interviews, one after the other like this, it would be intolerable. You'd have to be some like incredible actor.
It'd be exhausting.
Yeah, and have a script or something. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's any time for fucking about, you know, in terms of like how you talk about things. It's just, you just got to be straight. And it's just nice to be nice, isn't it? You know.
It certainly is. Well, thank you for not fucking about. I for one appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Ben.
Cheers, man. Ta-da.
Cheers. Ben Wheatley there, the very unpretentious Ben Wheatley, talking to me about his new movie version of Rebecca, which is out next Wednesday, I should say, the 21st of October, on Netflix. Now, the two leads in the movie, the husband and wife, Maximum De Winter and Mrs. De Winter, she never gets her Christian name in it, are played by Armie Hammer and Lily James. Lily James, of course, was in the news this week, I guess, as you described, for all the wrong reasons when photos of her emerged rather close with the married Dominic West. We didn't get into any of that. We just had a chat about the movie. Lily, this is, you know, a classic of English literature. You're an English gal. Was it a part that you had thought about before you got to do it? Was it ever on your frame before, or were you just sent the script and you thought, I'll do that?
Yeah, I was just sent the script, but I knew the book well. I mean, I hadn't read it since I was probably about 18 years old, but I knew the book, and I remembered the story, and I sort of, well, I re-remembered it as I read the script. And as soon as I did that, I was certain that I wanted to do it and be a part of it.
Armie, you're really good in it, obviously, but you feel like shaking you at times and just saying, would you not just talk to your wife, young man, and set everything straight? Of course, then there'd be no movie or book. I get that. But was it fun to you to play this kind of, you know, kind of emotionally, you know, incontinent kind of guy?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously challenges there within. I mean, I'm playing a guy who gives away nothing and sort of like has to just be the most guarded version of himself. But you're right. But John, also at the same time, like if he was the kind of character who was like, hey, listen, we need to have an actual emotional heart to heart. I need to talk to you about some trauma that I've experienced and what's going on in my life. maybe we can work through this together. The movie would be about 7 minutes long. They would just stay in France.
Yeah, exactly. All would be well.
Yeah, but it is fun playing a part like this. I mean, it's very different than sort of like how I kind of float through life. Like, I'm the kind of guy who's like, I got something to talk about. I'm gonna tell you all about it. And he's like the opposite of that. And it was fun. Yeah, it was just a great chance to get to work on.
And had you read the book?
No, I hadn't read it before.
Well, very honest of you to say that, because, you know, I've had experience of people lying in interviews about that kind of thing. It's Dickens' book, so fair play to you.
No, but you read it. You read it eventually.
Yeah, totally. No, I did. I read it. By the time when I got the job, I read it several times. Not nearly as many times as Lily did, but.
Lily, why don't we do a quick pop quiz with him? Maybe.
I'd love to. Let's do it. Take it away. Arby's going to do so badly in this guy.
Okay. If it's in the movie script, I got it. If it's in the book, I don't know.
And Lily, this, you know, you were famously in a big house before in Downton Abbey, and there was shades of that in this, but then it's completely different as well, because there's a touch of horror, there's all sorts of melodrama in it. Is she just such a kind of, you know, this woman who's desperately trying to get her husband to talk to her? Did she, I don't know, really appeal to you? There's just so much emotion there.
Yeah, I think that she has a huge, huge journey, and she's got so much conflict. She's so hemmed in by the time, by her situation and position in life. She's an orphan. She's, you know, this lady's companion. She's got no money. She's got no prospect, and she's really like, there's no color in life, and she's depressed. And then she enters into this world, and she's so in her head, and she battles so much anxiety. She's thrown way out of her depth. It's like there's just was so much to contend with, and she finds her voice, I think, through the film, and you see these two extremes of womanhood through Rebecca and through my character. And I just think that what the film explores about that, about women and men, that, you know, whole palaver, is really interesting and important, but within a very sort of commercial, gothic, enticing movie. Anyway, I hope so. That's certainly what the book does, and I think that's what our film does too.
No. It certainly does. And Army, you passed very well as an English gent on the French Riviera. It was the getting into that character, the accent, all that, hard. It seems like you carried it off blindingly.
Oh, thanks, dude. It's a fun thing to do is different accents. Like I've been lucky enough to do like different accents before, and like there's a musicality to them. And once you kind of tap into the musicality of an accent, then it starts to affect your thought pattern. It starts to affect all that. And you kind of get into it, which is great. It was made a little bit more difficult because, you know, the English are very good at taking the piss, and Ben and I know each other very well. So he had no problem just completely making fun of me the entire time. And, Kristen Scott Thomas would get after me sometimes about the accent. It was fun though. I mean, it was a little intimidating being the only American on a set playing, you know, one of the most famous English actors of all time, playing the same role he did. It was a lot.
Okay. Well, you wrote it out because it all worked well. Thank you both very much for talking to me. Have a good day.
Take care.
Bye, John.
Lily James and Armie Hammer there talking to me about their lead roles in the new Netflix version of Rebecca. Now, Mrs. Danvers is one of the main characters in Rebecca. She's the housekeeper who's kind of obsessed with Rebecca as well and doesn't really want any part of the new Mrs. De Winter in her house. In this version, she's played by the wonderful Kristen Scott Thomas, and I got to chat to her. My wife and I are both big fans of the book. I actually got it for my wife when I first met her, oddly enough. That's not a made-up story for one of these junkets. And she loved it. She was dying to watch it. And when she was watching the casting and she saw who was playing Mrs. Danvers, she went, oh, that's brilliant. That's inspired. Does that make you feel good or bad, the idea that someone thought you were perfectly cast as Mrs. Danvers?
Well, I've always thought of it as being a rather good feeling, but now you're beginning to worry me. No, I mean, she's the sort of evil character of all our nightmares, really, isn't she? Sort of scary headmistress type, but she certainly frightened an awful lot of people in other versions of this film, perhaps less so in the novel. Having said that, because in the novel she's described as, you know, she's very mysterious, but she's sort of very, very old and very, very little, and sort of quietly evil, whereas it more menacing. And I think she is very menacing in our film. She's very menacing.
Yeah.
And it is quite different from the Mrs. Danvers of the novel.
What I thought you did really well in it was what really comes across is that Mrs. Danvers, you know, and not to give a spoiler, she adores Rebecca, or she adored her, and that this was possibly the great love of her life, without any kind of saying any more than that. Is that what you felt, that this was the defining relationship of her life in a way?
Yeah, I do. I think when you think that she probably, we don't know anything about Mr. Danvers.
Yeah.
But I think we could possibly assume that because of the date the story was written in, that perhaps her husband had been killed in the First World War, like so many women lost their husbands or fiancés mm-hmm. in the First World War. So she was left in a status, left in a state where her her place in the world was somewhat reduced. So she'd been driven into caring for other people's children, becoming a governess. And so basically she became this governess to this wild little girl and her cousin. And this wild little girl was called Rebecca. And she brought this child up and sort of poured all her love into this child who wasn't her child. And love is blind, as you know. And
much to my delight.
Exactly. Phew. so she just had nothing but positive feelings for this child, who then became a woman, who then started to behave very strangely. But of course, Mrs. Danvers could see no wrong in that, and just worshipped the ground she walked on. And then it sort of flips into this strange area where no one's quite sure what her feelings would be categorized as. You know, is she in love with Rebecca, or is she just completely worshipping the ground she walks on? I have a feeling it is more of a worshipping than anything else. And then along comes this, you know, she dies in mysterious circumstances, which she feels for her own, particularly tragic because of her own intimate knowledge of Rebecca. Mm-hmm. And then along comes this sort of jumped up girl who's probably from a similar kind of background as Mrs. Danvers was, but, you know, has struck gold in that she's married a man rather than been left to her own devices. Because a man appeared, you know, and she has a sort of sexual jealousy the second Mrs. De Winter, played by Lily James, because, you know, she feels, you know, I could have had that too. I could have had my own husband and had my own house and been mistress of the place rather than just a servant.
Yeah. I just want to ask you one thing as I have you in front of me for 30 more seconds. One tiny little movie you were in back in 1994 about four weddings and a funeral. People always cite the scene in the church where the guy talks about stops the clocks. The scene that always gets me, and this is a spoiler, is when you say, "Oh, Charlie, it's you." I just think it's one of the most heartbreaking scenes in cinema I've ever seen. Is that a special scene for you personally, or is it just part of the gig as well? I don't know, you know?
No, that's the reason I wanted to do that film so much was because of that particular scene. You know, it's the obvious thing. I'm your best friend, but I've always been in love with you. And her thinking about it, she's confiding in her best friend, and then she's realizing that what she's saying is this incredible confession of unrequited love. And the person who experiences that just feels so small, and it's such a kind of it's such a brave thing to do, and yet I don't think she was doing it consciously. I think it just sort of fell out of her mouth, this confession, and I find it incredibly moving still, actually.
Well, I'm glad I asked you, even though I felt I shouldn't. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
Kristin Scott Thomas talking to me about Four Weddings and a Funeral. Why I'm Lucky Love Was Blind, and also, of course, about Rebecca, where she plays Mrs. Danvers. Now, finally, in Rebecca, Sam Riley plays the character Jack Favell. Jack Favell is this kind of bounder, vagabond character who's had some kind of relationship with Rebecca, and he re-enters. As I say, he's played by Sam Riley. Sam Riley has been in all sorts of things, but his breakthrough role and his best role was when he played Ian Curtis in Control, the biopic of the legendary Joy Division frontman. I caught up with Sam also.
You rarely hear the word bounder nowadays, but your character utters it. You play one as well. And I had to remind myself what a bounder was, but you're the perfect example of a bounder in this movie. Was that part of the appeal of it, to play this kind of raggy kind of ne'er-do-well?
Yeah. Short answer, John. I've done it. It's the third time I've worked with Ben Wheatley, yeah, the director, and I've played some sort of, on the scale of bounder to cad,
yeah,
via rogue every single time. I'm his caller cad. So yeah, it was a great, I love the part, and I've worked with Lily before, and Army, and Kristen, and yeah, Ben. So it was, yeah, a dream.
Why not? Had you read the book in school, or, you know, it's very English novel, as in it seems most, you know, people on your side of the pond have read it. Were you one of those?
No, no, I didn't. And I'm a very slow reader. So I usually, if it's based on a book, then, mm-hmm, I have to get the audio book.
Okay.
If they want me to have actually read it before we start.
And did you listen to the audio book of Rebecca for this?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, read by Anna Massey, who played, I think she played Lily's character in the television version. She read it really well. And so I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I wasn't aware of it before. I know some of Daphne du Maurier's short stories and things, but it's a great source material.
It certainly is. I'm a big fan of Ben's as well, from, you know, Sightseers, and he's just kind of a unique kind of voice. What kind of set does he, like, you're well placed to, he seems like a particular type of director, in that he has his own kind of, you know, cinematic language nearly. It's very distinctive what he does every time. What kind of set does he have going? Is it unusual? Is it different to other people's?
Well, it's often, I mean, the first time was quite intimidating because it was a film called Free Fire, and it was a really incredible ensemble, including an actor, you know, Brie Larson, who was just Oscar nominated. But it's often the same crew. Laurie Rose doing the camera often, and the same sound guys. And so in that sense, it's very familiar, and the way they talk to one another is sort of very calm, and they understand one another.
Yeah.
And I think everyone just really, actors really enjoy working with Ben, because he's a film buff as well. Yeah. I mean, he knows, you know, it's like an encyclopedia. And I really love working with him, because he gives me the feeling that he enjoys what I'm doing, which is the secret to any director's success. And I try and make him laugh. That's
I've watched a lot of movies, maybe not as much as Ben, but certainly a lot of them for this job. And I always say to people, you know, in the age of Rocket Man and Walk the Line, not to do any of those movies a disservice, but the greatest biopic, for want of a better phrase, ever, is Control. It's an amazing film.
You say all the right things.
No, John. No, but you were brilliant in it. And it's not like any other movie in that genre or in any other genre. And it's funny, I've maybe seen it seven times. The odd time it even pops into my head. Was that a big deal for you to play that wonderful, albeit troubled musician?
Oh yeah, I mean, it completely changed my life, John. I was an unsuccessful pub rock singer. Before that, I'd had a go at being an actor when I was 19 and didn't really get very far with it. And it completely, you know, I had nothing to lose. Although being a musician, I was skeptical about rock biopics because they're often naff, you know.
Yeah.
But I had nothing to lose. And I had amazing colleagues in Alexandra Maria Lara, who played Anique, and Samantha Morton, who played my wife, who really taught me how to act. And I put in a lot of hours doing the dancing, obviously. but it changed. I mean, I became an actor after that. You know, it's got me every job I've ever had since, really. I fell in love with my first co-star, went to go and live in Berlin. I'm still living there. So it completely changed my life. And I never really tire of hearing anything about the film, because it was one of the happiest bits of fortune I have ever had, really.
Great, great. Well, I was worried I might piss you off by asking you about it. So I'm glad.
No, you don't. No.
But you're also very good in Rebecca, by the way. So thanks a lot for talking to me. Real pleasure.
Thanks, John. Cheers. Love to Ireland. Stay safe.
Sam Riley there talking to me about his outstanding role as Ian Curtis in the best biopic, musical biopic ever, Control, if it even is a musical biopic. And of course, he was talking about his role in Rebecca on Netflix. There we go. A lot of stars this week. Another star after the break, Linda Martin on her favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. Now, I have previously in this spot spoken to two previous Eurovision winners, and I don't know why it took me so long to ask the wonderful Linda Martin. Hello, Linda.
Hello, John. You're very kind. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Now, I love this slot because you never know what people are going to choose, and I certainly didn't see this coming from you, but will you tell our listeners what your favourite movie is?
All right. My favourite movie, or should I say one of my favourite movies, is Le Cage aux Folles, better known as Birdcage. And it was released in 1996. And since then, I don't know how many times I've watched it, but the same reaction comes from me every time. I just literally be falling around laughing. It's a fabulous movie.
So, and we're talking about the kind of remake with Robin Williams and Gene Hackman, yes, as opposed to the, I think it was French or Italian or something, right? The original 78.
Yeah, it was a long, long time ago, yeah. And do you know what Le Cage aux Folles literally means?
No.
Well, it literally means a cage of mad women. So
I can see the headline now, Linda.
Maybe I should be in it with them. But it's just a fantastic feel-good movie. And what a cast. I mean, never mind Robin Williams. You've got Nathan Lane's, Gene Hackman, and the guy who played the Agadir Spartacus, you know, the housekeeper. Mm.
Oh, mother of God, he cracked me up. I mean, I never expected, when I first saw it, I didn't expect him to be doing the housekeeping in his bare feet because he can't wear shoes, nor did I expect him to be hoovering in his little budgie smugglers and singing a summer song at the same time. Just fantastic casting.
Will you remind people, because there'll be lots of people who won't have even have heard of it, what it's about exactly?
Well, very basically, it's set in Miami in a club, a gay club. And the owner of the club is Robin Williams and his partner is Nathan Lane. And years ago, the Robin Williams character had a one night stand with a lovely girl and a baby. They had a baby boy. Now, the mother hasn't seen the child for like something like 20 something years, but the child has always been in his dad's life. So he comes back. He appears in the club with something to tell his dad. And he said, "Dad, I'm getting married." And he's actually in the film, he's getting married to Calista Flockhart. Mm. So they take this all on board. And then the ensuing scenario is that Calista Flockhart's parents are really conservative. And he's a senator in America. And he has this really conservative cult group. So they want to come to the wedding. They want to come and meet the boyfriend's parents, of course. And the calamity surrounding Nathan Lane dressing up as a woman to pretend he's the mother. Then the real mother actually turning up. And so I swear to God, if you're listening, if you haven't seen this movie, I don't know if you can rent it. I don't know where you'd actually get it these days, but do try and get it. And trust me, you'll fall around laughing. Superb acting, a superb script. And at the end of the day, do you know something, John? It took in something like 185 million.
Mm.
Can you believe that? And I don't think it cost that much in movie terms to actually produce. It was something like about 90 million, something like that. But phenomenal success.
And what I love about it is Nathan Lane, people will know him from all sorts of things, but he was in Modern Family playing Pepper. He's just brilliant at it. Like Robin Williams is always brilliant and Gene Hackman are always brilliant. But Nathan Lane is just a ticket in it.
Yeah, he really is a superb actor. And he played the part brilliantly when he dressed up as the mammy. And the tantrums that he threw because he wasn't recognised and then he was found out. And it really is superb. I'd say they had great fun doing the filming.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I was in Miami a number of years ago, and I made it my business to go and find out where it was filmed.
Wow.
And I didn't get into the club, but I know where it is. But I tell you this much, if I'd had the opportunity to spend a night in that club, I'd have been there. I'd have been there for hours, because it just seemed like fun, great crack. What clubs actually should be, you know, with the little tables and the lamps on them and all that sort of business, which I love. And it's just brilliant. Please, please do try and see it.
I'm sure it's out there on some streaming place. I'm sure it's findable.
Yeah.
You know, you always know when someone's a big fan of a movie when they actually go and track down parts from it. Catherine Fulvio, a while ago, talking about going to the hotel in Pretty Woman. Jack L talked about going actually to the hotel in Some Like It Hot. And now you are tracking down nightclubs in Miami for the Birdcage.
Yeah,
so we
yeah.
know you're a serious fan of the movie.
Oh, no, it's just brilliant. It's my type of movie. I mean, there's other movies, of course, that I do like, and I would watch them repeatedly as well. But this one really comes out tops every time.
Yeah. Now, listen, I mentioned the two previous Eurovision people on the show, and
yes.
I'm talking about Charlie McGettigan and
Paul
Harrington on different stages last year. And, you know, I always take a beat when you ask someone who spent their lives talking about winning a Eurovision what it was like. But I was surprised, because both Paul and Charlie said to me, but I never mind being asked about that, because it was one of the best days of my life. And Charlie actually said it was probably the most satisfaction I ever got singing a song on a stage. And I'm wondering how you are about Why Me now, all these years since, the people like me still ask you about it.
Listen, ask me anything about Eurovision. I really am delighted. It's been so good to me. I really think it's a privilege to put something back in another person's mind who may not know so much about Eurovision, you know. So I really do not mind being asked about it. I agree with Charlie and Paul that it was the pinnacle in my career so far anyway, unless something miraculous happens tomorrow, which I doubt. But it's been the pinnacle, and it's something I will never, ever forget.
Yeah, well, come, the sun hasn't set just yet now, Linda. So, you know, there's lots of long days before you. Let me ask you then, and you probably asked this as well, but, you know, you're the queen of Eurovision. Are you bemused by where it's at these days? I know there wasn't really one this year, but I mean, in terms of what's gone on with block voting and all sorts of stuff. Do you long for a simpler time in Eurovision?
Yes, I do. I really do. I long for the orchestra to come back.
Right.
I long for the days when there were only 24, 25 countries in it as opposed to 43. Because I genuinely, I don't watch the semis. I've no interest in them. I just want to see the contest on the night. And even with the voting, you know, the way they don't actually just vote for 25 countries. There's 43 countries can cast their vote. And I find that boring as well. So there are things that I'd love to change about it. But I'm not in control with the EBU or anything like it. So I don't think it's going to happen. But I do wish we could come back to simpler times.
Indeed. And then finally, Linda, like we ask everyone in this slot, just the state of the world at the moment. How has lockdown been going for you, and how's it continuously going, as it shows no sign of abating?
It's no sign of abating. I haven't worked since March.
Right.
Don't feel that any of us in show business are going to be working until next March at the earliest. Like, that's really earliest.
Yeah.
I live in the countryside. I'm lucky in that way because I can get out. I quite like the isolation. My garden has never looked better. And do you know something? Do you know what I'm wearing at the moment?
Wow. This is taking a turn.
This will turn you on. Now, we hired a power washer this morning, this petrol driven thing, because we've a huge front at the house, right? So at the moment, I've a beanie on my head. I'm covered in splashes from the washer itself. And I'm wearing fisherman's waders, which are right up to below my chest, with a pair of welly boots on.
This is getting X-rated.
No, I'm telling you, it's some sight. I swear to you, you'd swear I had black measles. That's what my face looks like at the moment. But that's what I've been doing. I painted every room in the house. I don't think there's anywhere left to clean at this stage. My dog sort of run away from me because they're saying, oh, geez, this mad woman's coming to wash us once again. You know, so I just get on with it. I'm like everybody else. I'm not complaining. I just do my best. When Tony Houlihan tells me to do something, I do it. Everybody else is saying do this and somebody else is saying do that. But the reality for me is when that man speaks, then I go and do what I'm told. And at the moment, that is exactly what we're doing here.
It's a real delight and a tonic to talk to you, Linda. Her favourite movie is The Birdcage. Thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Take care.
He's just a baby. He's too young. He'll ruin his life.
Listen, we've been through all that, all right? Bottom line is he's getting married no matter what we say, so the less said, the better.
Oh, my God. Oh, I woke up feeling so good. Now all of a sudden I feel so funny.
Just breathe. Let it go. Breathe. Oh, you've heard.
Oh, Valley. Oh, my God. This is such a shock. I'm not saying anything. I promised your father. Mm-mm. But you're only 20, and if you throw yourself away on some dormitory slut, you'll be sorry for the rest of your life. There, enough said. That's all. No more.
Nathan Lane and Robin Williams in the very funny The Birdcage, as chosen by Linda Martin as her favourite movie, and my thanks to her. That is it for this week after a very busy show. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helps out on the show. Just to remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I'm open all week long. On Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com.